January 22nd meeting of the Higher Education Committee to order at 1:01. Members, we're going to start today with a presentation from the Masonic Cancer Center. Dr. Yi, if you could make your way to the table. Welcome, Dr. Yi.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I want to introduce Marie Ronnie, who is the program manager of the Minnesota Cancer Clinical Trials Network.
Wonderful. Welcome. So, welcome. If you could just introduce yourself for the tape, and then whenever you're ready, you go ahead.
Okay. I'm Doug Yi, and I represent the Masonic Cancer Center, University of Minnesota. To put this in perspective, I want to actually just tell you a few things about cancer and outcomes. So several weeks ago, there was a very important report that came out from the American Cancer Society showing the 2019 statistics for cancer, and it showed that fewer Americans were dying of cancer now than we've seen in the past 20 or 30 years. This is a tremendous advance, and if you think about why this is happening and why is it happening now, I think there are a couple of factors that are important for you to recognize. First off, the funding body for most of the cancer research in this country, the National Cancer Institute, awards centers that have exceptional cancer research. I think you should be proud, or we should all be proud as Minnesotans. We have two National Cancer Institute designated comprehensive cancer centers in our state. If you look at our neighbors, Wisconsin or Iowa, where there may be one, and we're a little bit of a smaller state than some of those. We have two. We have one based here at the University of Minnesota, and we also have one at the Mayo Clinic. So that's a tremendous accomplishment for our state, and the things that comprehensive cancer centers do is recognize the breadth and depth of causes of cancer, screening for cancer, treatment for cancer, and survivorship issues. At the same time, the National Cancer Institute has recognized that much cancer research is done at other places. So there's an entity called the National Community Oncology Research Program, or NCORP. The NCORPs are designed to bring clinical research to sites where they may not have a cancer center. So we have two in our state. One is based in Metro Minnesota, and one is based in the Essentia Healthcare System in Duluth. The third entity that serves our state, it's another National Community Oncology Research Program, is based in the Sanford System. The Sanford System serves the western parts of the state. So with that background, it gives you a little bit of the cancer research and the cancer clinical trials network that exists within our state. So I want to come back to what I said in the beginning. The statistics for cancer research have shown outcomes are improving, and much of that is because the science that has been discovered in academic centers like us and the Mayo Clinic have translated directly into improvements for patient care. And I think I tell people as an oncologist, and I'm a medical oncologist, so I treat the medical aspects of cancer, and I actually specialize in breast cancer. Not to tell you what my morning was like, but this morning I was on the phone with an insurance company trying to make sure we had coverage for a brand new drug that was just approved in breast cancer, and it was improved because the cancer clinical research and the clinical trials made it show as such that showed that this drug was extraordinarily effective for the treatment of certain types of breast cancer. The insurance company, just as an aside, wasn't quite up to date on the latest data, but that's okay. That's my job, and hopefully that will go forward. If you asked me when I started my career almost 30 years ago now, would I have even envisioned a drug like this being applied to women with breast cancer, I'd have to say no. You know, we didn't understand lots of things about breast cancer, and we certainly did not understand that this particular molecular pathway that this drug targets would be extraordinarily useful in a small subset of cancer patients. So that's the background, and I think we've made advances because largely patients have been willing to participate with us in the research effort. We call those clinical trials. So when a new drug comes forward, we ask patients to volunteer to help us understand whether the new drug or the new pathway actually is going to change outcomes for patients. And that we've been very lucky over the past, again, 30 years, the new drug strategies have dramatically improved outcomes for cancer patients. So what's the downside of this argument? So one downside is Very few cancer patients actually participate in cancer clinical trials. Somewhere south of 5% of all patients eligible for a clinical trial participate. If you think about the speed of research or the speed of advances or improvement, if you could just double that number, that would be an incredible advance. The other aspect that we understand within the cancer research world, that there are substantial disparities between different populations. And the National Cancer Institute has identified those disparities. Some are socioeconomic, but a major disparity is rural health care. So rural health care and limited access to clinical trials results in decreased or worse outcomes for many cancer subtypes. So that's a long background to tell you where we are at the Minnesota Cancer Clinical Trials Network. 2 years ago, I think as part of the MnDrive initiative, we came and talked about what we wanted to create, and what we wanted to create was a statewide network to allow patients to enroll on cancer clinical trials that may not have that opportunity otherwise because they live in an area remote from one of the centers that we've talked about. To do that, we established a partnership between the two comprehensive cancer centers, ourselves and the Mayo Clinic. One of the other areas of cancer research in the state is the Hormel Institute in Austin, Minnesota, as the three community oncology research programs, the one at Duluth, the one in Metro Minnesota, and the one based at Sanford. And by doing that, we wanted to make sure that patients throughout the entire state had access to trials that came from the good science that occurs within the two cancer centers and nationally. So you have two handouts in your packet. One of them has kind of words in a box, and one of them has a map. And I'm not going to read every single thing on this, but it really is for your information. I do want to read, though, our mission statement, and that's to improve cancer outcomes for all Minnesotans through greater access to cancer clinical trials and prevention and treatment. So as mentioned, this has been funded by the legislature, and we're very, very grateful for that support. We lead the network, but the network is composed of other National Cancer Institute-funded entities, included our two cancer centers. And what we do is we provide the resources for sites that are not used to doing cancer research to do cancer research. And what I mean by that is I think when we all go to the doctor, we understand there's an infrastructure that underlies your visit. There's someone who checks you in. There may be a nurse that you work with to do your vital signs. There's somebody in the billing office managing the bills. All that is part of clinical care. When you do cancer research and when you do cancer clinical trials, there's another layer of care that we build into the system. We have research nurses who are specifically responsible for the trial. We have data coordinators that manage all the results from the trials that we have. And we've actually been very lucky within our two comprehensive cancer centers to have that level of support. But if you're a small practice in Thief River Falls, for example, you do not have that ability to maintain research data at the level we need to do to support clinical trials, and that's really where the Cancer Network comes in. We wanted to bring the good ideas from the two comprehensive cancer centers and through the National Cooperative Group mechanism to patients who were not otherwise be offered these opportunities. I tell my patients that you should always ask your doctor if you're eligible for a clinical trial. And the reason I tell patients to do that is that because it gives them the opportunity to have an outcome that's better than the standard of care. Quite frankly, if we were happy with the standard of care, if all our cancer outcomes were okay, we'd say we're done. We don't need to do any more clinical research. In fact, I'd love to be at that point sometime. But currently, we are not that way, and the cancer clinical trials help us bring new ideas to patients. I always tell my patients when I talk about clinical trials that today's ceiling is tomorrow's floor. In other words, if I were using the same methods of care that I learned when I was a junior faculty member, I'd be hopelessly outdated, and I would not be providing good care for my patients. So cancer clinical research is a standard of higher care than we currently exist, and we hope to move the field forward. So on this front page, there's a timeline of what has happened. Again, in July in 2017, the funding was approved, and several milestones were shown on this particular paper that we have identified and begin to enroll patients. On the back side of this paper identifies the key people who are involved in this network. As I mentioned, we are the steering committee, and I chair the steering committee. And Marie Ronnie is the senior administrator and program manager for this entire network. As mentioned, we have colleagues at Essentia, within the Fairview Health System, within Hormel, within Mayo Clinic, within the NCORP based in Metro Minnesota, which is called MCORC. We have a very important collaboration of the Middle X Band of Ojibwe and Sanford Health. I want to say a word about the Middle X Band of Ojibwe collaboration. When I talk about cancer clinical trials, I think many of you believe that I'm talking about, well, you have cancer, and then you need a better treatment. And that's certainly an extraordinarily important part of what we do in the Minnesota Cancer Clinical Trials Network. But equally important is prevention and reducing the risk for patients who might be exposed to something that will lead to cancer eventually. And that's where the Middle X Band of Ojibwe collaboration comes from. You probably know that 90% of all lung cancers can be attributed to tobacco and cigarette smoking. You may also know that our state has done a very good job of controlling tobacco access. Roughly the prevalence of smoking in Minnesota now is 16%. In contrast, in the Middle X Band of Ojibwe, the prevalence of cigarette smoking is more like 60%. And that's a major issue for long-term health of the tribal members. They actually reached out to the University of Minnesota to help with tobacco control programs. They recognize that this is a threat, and I know we're talking about cancer, but certainly cigarette smoking lines up with cardiovascular disease and other health outcomes as well to help reduce the risk. So some of my colleagues at the university have been working on this collaboration for several years. I do want to just point out some aspects that I think are, to me, unique. One of the things we've understood within tobacco is that different people have different levels of being addicted to nicotine. So not everyone has the same risk. Depending on how you metabolize nicotine, you may be more or less addicted. So, for example, if you are a smoker and you metabolize nicotine very rapidly, and nicotine is a substance you want, you'll smoke a lot more. And if you smoke a lot more, that increases your risk for tobacco-related smoking. We understand those differences in nicotine metabolism are managed by a couple of genes. And we have studied at the University of Minnesota, Masonic Cancer Center, that certain genes are very important in nicotine metabolism, and that people who are rapid metabolizers have a higher risk of cancer and maybe need to be counseled in a different way, and people who are slow metabolizers have a lower risk because they smoke less. The genomic composition of Native American, American Indian tribes is largely unknown. We made this observation on African American populations, Asian populations, and Caucasian populations, but certainly that particular piece of information needs to be understood if we're going to provide effective tobacco control measures for our population. So one of the things about this collaboration is that the Middle X Band actually controls other genomic data. We have established an excellent collaboration. We've had a research coordinator with funding from MnDRIBE. We've been able to purchase some storage freezers for them to maintain their genomic data on their own. I think you probably are aware of the concern that Native American tribes have about genomic testing, but I think one of the solutions that you were able to afford us with, so to speak, is to allow the tribes to control their own genomic data. To me, that's a very important advance. I think that actually is going to be an extraordinarily important template for our relationship with tribes throughout the state, and I hope that this will grow as part of the initiative. So I wanted to point that out because their relationship is slightly different with us than the other medical centers, but I think it's an extraordinarily important one and room for growth. So the next page, the one with the map, has all the sites that are open and enrolling, and you can see the cities where they're enrolling. I will point out one thing that is sort of obvious to me is that we're missing a part of the state around St. Cloud, and it's not because we haven't tried. St. Cloud care is mainly managed by CentraCare. CentraCare is an excellent research institution as well. But when we talked to them a year ago, they said they needed a year to get some internal processes in place before they could join the network. So on our to-do list for the next year is to make sure CentraCare is involved with the Minnesota Cancer Clinical Trials Network. This outline also talks a little bit about kind of corollary benefits of having a clinical trial. We can advance knowledge for providers. We can provide more information for Minnesotans. And I hope by addressing the populations that we're enrolling, we can remove barriers to participation in cancer clinical trial. We can do this a couple ways. One of them is to decrease the distance patients have to travel. If we have a site that's closer to them, then that will encourage participation. Time, cost, and comfort of traveling far away from home are very important reasons why patients do not participate in trials. Again, an example from my life. I have a patient who's eligible for a trial. She lives outside of Brainerd, and she just said, I can't come back every 3 weeks to participate. So I think, you know, for me, that is one of the reasons the network exists. This particular trial I'm talking about is not up and running yet in Brainerd, but eventually that's the goal and that's what we would like to do. And on the back page, gives you a little bit of our metrics so far. We've enrolled 95 Minnesotans on trials, which may not seem like a big number, but one of the things that I think you should take pride in is allowing us to put together healthcare systems that usually do not work together. And what I mean by that is every one of the healthcare systems I talked about is a separate corporate entity. And because they're a separate corporate entity, we had to do a fair amount of negotiation, and Marie can probably tell you this in gory detail, with all of the sites to make sure that we could sign the contract. So even though the funding came through a couple years ago, we're on the upward phase of ramping once we had all the agreements put in place. One of the first trials we're sending out is a trial on ginger. Ginger is an interesting compound. It has lots of anti-cancer properties. The clinical trial we're participating in or we're opening up through the network is for patients who have had colonic polyps through a colonoscopy. Then they're assigned to take a ginger pill for a year. And when their next colonoscopy comes through or the next samples come through, we can see if we change the composition of the bacteria in their colon. We're starting to understand the bacteria in your colon, the bacteria in your entire body affects a lot of health risks, and some of the bacteria in our colon are associated with increasing colon cancer risk. So I said there was some good news about cancer statistics in general. One of the not-so-good news is an increasing risk of colon cancer in young and old people. It's overstating for me to say that if we could change the bacteria in your colon by having you take a ginger supplement a day, you could reduce your cancer risk substantially, but that's the point of this research. The research suggests some of the compounds within ginger are very effective at killing the bad bacteria in your colon, and that's what we're going to test. Other trials are shown here. There are five more in the pipeline. There is an economic impact of this network as well. We have physicians and investigators engaged. We have regulatory, administrative, and other new people engaged that were not doing clinical research before, 22 nurse and research coordinators, and laboratories and pharmacies who were brought into the system. So I will end there. I'd love to take your questions, but I just wanted to thank you again how insightful you were in moving this forward. As a cancer center director, I go to meetings where all the cancer center directors meet. And I'm not aware of another program like this within the United States that really allows us to engage networks of healthcare throughout our state to improve cancer outcomes by performing cancer clinical research. So thanks very much. I'd be happy to take any questions.
There's any questions for Dr. Yee? Senator Claassen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question. I know that we hear frequently that the VA system deals a lot with cancer issues caused environmentally from the debris. Sorry. Saying that the VA deals a lot with cancer patients, and I noticed that they're kind of missing from this. Can you maybe comment on that, about were there attempts to try to get the VA system involved, or just an overview, if you would, on that issue?
Yeah, Dr. Yee. In our initial attempts, we've tried to include centers outside of a 30-mile radius of a major metropolitan center. Our goal was to really engage those centers that there's absolutely no healthcare clinical research capacity. And the VA, at least the VA within the Twin Cities, is, you know, certainly falls within that radius. I would like to engage the VA. In fact, you know, within the Masonic Cancer Center, we engage the VA in many aspects of clinical research. I actually think as this network evolves and as we report back to you, I'd like to see this network enhance clinical trial accrual to all our underserved populations. So we talked a little bit about rural areas are underserved, but I think there's certainly areas within the Twin Cities and with urban areas that are underserved too based on socioeconomic class. The VA is not exactly that, but VA has some features where we could do a great job by enhancing clinical trial research through the VA system. And again, one thing about the VA system is they have a really fabulous electronic medical record. The VA system to date has been fairly proprietary, kept things within the VA system, but I think we can come to some data sharing agreements that would be useful for everybody.
Senator Isaacson.
Thank you. Just looking at your brochure here, I see your partners below here. How engaged are each one of them? Are they all pretty equal, or are there varying sizes of their engagement? Like, how engaged is Sanford compared to the Masonic Center?
Marie, I don't know if you want to take that question because you're on most of the operations calls.
Sure. Thank you.
If you could just identify yourself for the record as well. Thank you.
I'm Marie Ronnie. I'm the senior manager of the MNCCTN. So all of our partners are very highly engaged in the network, and that's partially because we provide them funding to do so. So for their time and energy to make this program work, we have Sam. Each of the partners has a different number of sites that they are funding with their support. So for example, Sanford has two sites that they're working with in Greater Minnesota. Accenture has 7, I believe, this first year. So they're engaged a little bit differently in scope, but certainly they're all engaged in the same way as far as attention and doing their work on the committees and subcommittees, helping with the decision making of the network and the direction and so forth.
Yeah, and I want to emphasize the Sanford participation is for their clinics in the western half of the state.
Senator Isaacson.
Thank you. And so this isn't a means by which there could be expansion from one to another or in your partnership, right, where we would see Sanford starting to have more clinics as they creep eastward or anything like that, correct?
We've made it very clear throughout the network that this is not about business or market share. We made it very clear through the network that this is for opportunities for patients who should have the ability to participate in clinical trials. So we are very careful to make sure that any expenses or any personnel that are supported by the network are solely dedicated and only dedicated to the research efforts.
Perfect. Thank you.
Senator Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How does one subscribe or get involved with the clinical trials? Do you go through your personal doctor and ask that they submit your name? Or
yeah, so again, that is really where I advise most patients to ask their doctors, especially if you're embarking on a new therapeutic plan, to say, are you involved? On the global scale, there are large trials that are managed by the National Cancer Institute. They're called the cooperative groups. So the cooperative groups have a portfolio of trials that many centers open, including the two centers listed here, the Metro Minnesota, as well as the Accenture NCORP. There are also pharmacy-driven trials as well. Right now, the Minnesota Cancer Clinical Trials Network is not hosting any pharmacy-driven or pharmaceutical company-driven trials, but certainly there are many interesting drugs that come through that pathway. And finally, there are investigator-initiated trials where I have a good idea, and I think I'd like to be able to test this, and that's where we'd like to use the network as well. But to get at the basic question of how will you know as a consumer whether your entity actually has a trial for the thing that you're being treated for? It's not easy, actually. It's very difficult to find that information. There is a central site called clinicaltrials.gov that lists every clinical trial in the world that's being done for any disease entity. And when I say it's not easy, that's not a user-friendly site. So I always make sure that patients ask their physicians. And then once, direct example, so I saw a patient who was newly diagnosed with breast cancer. She was eligible for a clinical trial. We went over her options, what we would do, what is the standard of care, and then we spent some time talking about what the clinical trial involves. When I said there's some collateral benefits for this network, I think by asking physicians to explain to their patients why we're suggesting what we're suggesting and where our gaps are, that improves patient care. So our ability to offer trials, and the physicians have to explain why we're doing the trial, really does improve communication with patients and makes patients a better consumer, if you will, of healthcare. They will really understand why we're doing what we're doing.
Senator Newton.
Thank you, and Dr. Yee. My wife is going in for breast surgery on Thursday.
Okay.
So we're concerned with this. So these trials, is that a substitute for surgery? Is it option that someone has that you can go to a trial rather than have surgery?
At least for breast cancer or breast masses, the primary treatment is surgery, but I don't want to go too far into what I'm interested in, but I'm interested in trying to give some of the medical therapies before surgery to try to understand if we can improve outcomes by treating prior to surgery. Now, not all women need that. In fact, the vast majority of women have low-risk tumors. Surgery is the first option, and then determining whether they need any medical therapy at all afterwards is the standard of care. But again, you know, I think for me personally, improving the standard of care is what we need to do, and that's really a little bit why we are offering surgery for, medical therapy for some patients prior to surgery.
Members, any additional questions? Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see in the, you listed five trials in the pipeline, one of them being blood trials. I'm just curious, what types of cancers will you be addressing through those trials?
So the blood trials, this particular category, that's a good question. If I have that detail, what the trial is for that particular subgroup. I think that trial, okay. So there, the two trials that we're trying to open that are blood trials, one of them is in multiple myeloma, which is a disease of B cells that produce too much antibody. And the second one is a funny disease we call myelodysplastic syndrome. Myelodysplastic syndrome is commonly referred to as pre-leukemia. They're not quite exactly leukemias yet, and the goal is to keep them in their sort of pre-leukemia stage.
Dr. Yee and Ms. Rainey, thank you for your testimony. We appreciate it.
Well, Senator Anderson and Senators, thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to talk to you about our progress. And I just again want to express on behalf of all the cancer physicians in the state how grateful we are for your foresightfulness in providing this funding.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That will have Professor Wieben and Professor Libian come on up. And now we're going to have the presentation from the Minnesota Partnership for Biotechnology and Medical Genomics. Whenever you're ready, if you could just introduce yourself for the tape and start whenever you're ready.
So while Eric's hooking up the laptop here, I'll introduce myself. I'm Tucker Libian. I'm a professor of laboratory medicine and pathology at the University of Minnesota Medical School, and the operational director for the Minnesota Partnership on the university side.
And I'm Eric Wieben. I am the project director for the Minnesota Partnership for Biotechnology and Medical Genomics from the Mayo Clinic side. What we'd like to do today is to have a brief presentation. I will be going over some of the history of the Minnesota Partnership because I've been involved since the beginning of this endeavor. And Dr. LeBien is then going to give you some of the exciting news about new initiatives that we've had as a part of this program that are seeking to help our outcomes on some of the goals, the broad goals we've had for the Minnesota Partnership. As you can see on this first slide, there are two goals really to the Minnesota Partnership as it was conceived back in 2003, and one is to improve life for Minnesotans by creating advances in medical science and medical care that can help to improve medical care for Minnesota citizens. And the other is to stimulate Minnesota's economy by developing some intellectual property and other knowledge-based things that might have some economic benefit for the state. This initiative did arise out of both institutions' sizable investments in background development to make this partnership more creative and accessible. And it really has leveraged a lot of the background investments to help us move forward. And one of the things that just illustrates some of the national and, in fact, international recognition that the partnership has produced is this quote from Jordan Cohen, who in 2003 was the president of the AAMC, the American Association of Medical Colleges. And in his presidential address that year, I won't read this all, but he quotes the idea that rather than compete with one another to acquire reduplicated research capacity, like-minded institutions should pool their resources, avoid unnecessary redundancy, and pursue questions that all agree are now susceptible to answer. A case in point is the recently announced agreement by two long-standing rivals, the Mayo Clinic and the University of Minnesota, to join forces on a number of prospective research projects. And he goes on to talk about how this is a great approach and there ought to be more things like it. This is, as I said, one example of some of the national and international recognition we've had as a result of the Minnesota Partnership activities since April of 2003. Brief highlight of how we got started. Back in 2003, there was a growing realization that the new genomic revolution and biotechnology revolutions had both tremendous potential for improving healthcare and some potential economic benefits for the state. And so discussions were initiated by leadership at both institutions seeking some additional support to increase the amount of funding available for these worthwhile initiatives across the state. And after some discussions, the decision was made to make this a three-way partnership between Mayo Clinic, University of Minnesota, and the state of Minnesota to really try to attack some of these questions on a broader basis. And the partnership was announced in April of 2003. The initial funding was useful in helping us provide some seed funding for some initial projects, and those projects and awards were announced and funded in 2004. The initial appropriation from the state was $2 million, and that was matched by $1 million from Mayo and $1 million from the University of Minnesota. And with that initial $4 million funding, we funded four projects in the areas of heart disease, cancer, Alzheimer's, and obesity, four major health problems within our state, and set out to see how successful these collaborations could be. I would note that those four projects were from a pool of, I believe at that time it was 35 or 40 applications we had for that rounding, and that's typical of our awards, is that the actual success rate is in the vicinity of 10 to 20% of the applications actually get funded. From that proof of principle, we had some initial early successes and moved into a second phase of building the partnership. And that did include, as this slide shows, a bonding project to provide some additional space for partnership activities at Mayo Clinic and some larger appropriations to help us really jumpstart the next round of real extensive research activities. And that included $5 million from Medica, who supported our goals because they felt that there was going to be benefit to health for Minnesotans. At this point, the state investment in this three-way partnership is $8 million annually, and it really spans the continuum of research and application of medical science studies, going from the discovery, finding new knowledge and new approaches to being able to make a difference in terms of healthcare, going through this translation process where that initial finding gets translated into something that has real applicability within the clinic, and finally the application where this becomes a routine part of medical care. Traditionally, we've done things on the left side of this slide, small research awards, and I say small, but basically the average award size is about $1 million over 2 years, and since each of these awards has a proponent from Mayo working with a proponent from the University of Minnesota, that money gets split relatively evenly between those two sides. The other thing we've supported for a number of years now is these infrastructure awards that help us build facilities and capabilities that are accessible to investigators from both institutions that can really advance lots of research across the state. The new thing that Dr. LeBien is going to be talking about in just a minute is this Translational Product Development Fund, and that is designed to help us bridge the gap that goes from basic discovery to real application, and it's focused much more on how do we get really promising discoveries into useful applicability for patients and for further economic development, and he'll tell you more about that in a minute. In terms of outcomes over the first years of the partnership, we've awarded over $137 million for 131 competitive and collaborative projects, and again, that funding rate is always been less than 20% of the applications we've received. And from that, we've leveraged over 500 external grant awards, including more than $157 million in new National Institute of Health funding, $15 million in philanthropic contributions, $5 million in private industry investment. That's that Medica award that I mentioned. And in addition, there's been additional funding that's come from things like the European Union. So we've attracted some notice in Europe for our activities, and some collaborative projects have actually been started in places like the Czech Republic that attracted European Union funding. We've published a lot of papers in the best scientific journals. We've had a number of patent filings, including 3 issued patents, others that are still in process of being evaluated and approved, and 29 new technologies, of which 3 have been licensed. I'll give you a few more details about that in just a second. Here are just 3 examples of the type of projects we funded. This first one was one of those initial pilot projects from those first 4 that we funded, and it's got a long title. It's called Coordinated Multiprogram Utilization of Microarray Data to Generate and Validate Biomarkers for Improved Care of Patients with Prostate Cancer. To translate that into more approachable English, basically what it's looking for is markers that try to differentiate really aggressive prostate cancer that needs aggressive treatment and prostate cancer that is really of no threat to the life of that particular patient and which is indolent enough to not likely to require really aggressive therapies. And that has been very successful. There are 3 patents issued associated with this work. It has been licensed to, I believe, 4 different groups now, and it is continuing to make a real difference in the lives of a number of patients. The second example is one that we just funded this year, and it's also got an interesting title of Retinal Hyperspectral Imaging, a tool for early detection of Alzheimer's. And the prospect of this particular project is to use the eye, which is basically a developmental extension of the brain, as a potential diagnostic mode for early-stage Alzheimer's. So the colleagues at the University of Minnesota have developed some really interesting imaging capabilities that let them scan the retina of a person. So a non-invasive, easy and quick and relatively cheap test to see if there are what's called amyloid depositions in that retina that might show that Alzheimer's is at the early stages in that patient. If this is successful, it will allow for earlier interventions and potential ways to determine whether prospective treatments are going to be helpful in staving off the devastating effects of Alzheimer's. So we're really excited about this prospect. The third example is here is a infrastructure project, the type I mentioned, and it's basically in support of new imaging capabilities that are going to be accessible to investigators in University of Minnesota Duluth, Twin Cities, Hormel Institute, and Mayo, all for the benefit of fundamental research in cell biology that might be affecting health. All of these outcomes that we've had, we think it's a pretty impressive record, but this slide is just put in to emphasize that the pipeline between basic discovery and most of those research awards I've been discussing takes a number of years, and you'll see that the time scale here in years is out to about 15 years before a basic discovery can actually have an impact in terms of real clinical care and other types of economic development. And we have been focusing over most of this first years of the partnership on the left side of this slide in terms of concept and trying to get additional NIH funding and creating some initial short-term prospects there in licensing and patents. And now the program that Dr. LeBien is going to be telling you about is focused more on the right side of this and how do we try to get things more efficiently translated from basic discovery into things that can have an impact on patients. So at this point, I will turn it over to my colleague and let him tell you about what we call the Translational Product Development Fund.
Thank you, Eric. Chair Anderson, I might just ask whether there are questions at this juncture. Not my role to request questions, but I just ask you if you want to take a pause.
Ed.
Okay, thank you. So several years ago, the Executive Committee of the Partnership, which is myself, Dr. Wieben, Dean Vice President Jacob Tolar at the University, and Executive Dean for Research Greg Goris at Mayo, we had a long conversation about the status of the partnership, and despite the extraordinary success stories that Eric has shared with you today, and for which we'd be happy on any occasion, in any circumstance, to take a much deeper dive because the portfolio of supported projects is remarkable, we realized that it was time to make some changes in the program to facilitate the development of endpoints such as commercialization of products or phase one clinical trials that really were expected. If you go back to the original conversation that the legislature had around this initiative of some 15 years ago, there was an expectation that this would not simply be a research fund, but that it would be a fund that would enhance the well-being of citizens of Minnesota, that it could provide jobs, et cetera. So what we did, and when the we in this case, the lead on this is myself and my colleague, Dr. Andrew Badley from Mayo, is that we created a program called the Translational Product Development Fund, which is shown on this slide, and which has a vision to impact the lives of Minnesota citizens through the translation, commercialization of research discoveries into new medical devices, therapies, et cetera. So the difference between this program and the ongoing partnership research grant program is that we solicit applications that very specifically propose to develop novel therapeutics, devices, IT technology, new software, for example, and that also, and this is an extremely important point, in order for the project to be eligible for consideration, either the Mayo, the university, or the team must have filed a disclosure with, in the university side, the Office of Technology and Commercialization, or TechCom, they've changed their name now. On the Mayo Clinic side, it's Mayo Clinic Ventures. So that in order to be eligible to even apply, the applicants must show evidence that they have an invention that is sufficiently matured that they can file an invention disclosure at the respective institutions. So the significance of this is that that really automatically, in a sense, selects for projects for which the faculty are quite far along in their thinking about the potential application of this to impact human health. The other thing we did, which is a kind of an administrative, albeit very important one, with respect to the management of these grants, most grant programs, including the partnership, are such that when an award is made, we expect progress reports, but we have no role in either evaluating the research, overseeing the research, et cetera. In the TPDF program, we have developed a model where we have project development teams of a small team of experts around each one of these awards. So, for example, let's say that we had a project we funded that was developing a new device for cardiac repair. The faculty member, I can assure you, is an expert in cardiac repair, but may know very little about the regulatory issues and IRB issues and FDA issues that have to be tackled in order for this to move forward. So we've utilized that model to help facilitate the movement of these projects via conduct and successful conduct of specific milestones. So the program is only 3 years old. We've had about 200 submissions. Now, I should pause here. We have a letter of intent. This is really nuanced, but I don't want you to think that this thing is so competitive. How can you possibly pick the winners? We have 200 submissions, and we have a letter of intent process where we screen them to make sure they meet the criteria and that they look like they're feasible. And that actually reduces the number of full submissions down to about 80. So from that 80, we made 18 awards, 25% or so success rate, and you can see the different kind of buckets that these projects were working in with respect to devices, therapeutics, et cetera. So key program outcomes is that the investment, and these are initially $50,000 awards, they're much smaller than the, actually about $80,000 in total, much smaller than the partnership awards. But we've already seen about $4 million in additional project funding secured. With respect to these 18 funded projects, the faculty who oversee those have 91 total patents associated with these projects. Now, that doesn't mean that these patents were awarded, of course, as a direct consequence of this. But these are patents that are at various stages of filing that reflect the kind of innovation and creativity in these projects that we expect. I'm going to show you an example of some of the successes we've already had with respect to three licensing agreements. So just very briefly, Dr. Dougie made brief mention about how important the microbiome, that is the actual makeup of your microbes in your gut or your lung or whatever, are in influencing human health. And there are now technologies, DNA sequencing technologies, where the biome of any of us can be sequenced in a very short period of time, but the analysis of that data is extremely complicated. So there was a startup company at the university called CoreBiome, and one of the projects that we funded licensed their success story to CoreBiome, and basically this is what we call an enabling technology, which makes it easier to essentially evaluate and interpret this huge amount of sequencing data that comes out of these exercises. This company has already been acquired in the last 2 months by a company in the East Coast called OraSure Technologies, so we view that, at least at this juncture, as a positive. We had another very interesting one. This was done by both Mayo Clinic and University faculty. And unbeknownst to me, not being a cardiologist, I couldn't fully appreciate the complexity of data surrounding individuals who are being cared for in the ICU, for example, particularly in rural access hospitals. And this team put together a technology that aggregates and organizes this data. So basically what it's doing is just pulling in data from various sources and putting it into an easier-to-read and understand data set that we anticipate is going to greatly improve the ability to take care of these individuals. And finally, in one called Ambulatory Non-Invasive Measurement of Potassium, patients with cardiac and renal disease. There are countless software technologies that are being developed, as you all know, that are compatible with your iPhones. And in this case, the level of potassium in your blood is extremely important. And, of course, if the potassium level drops, that puts you at risk for a number of renal and cardiac problems. So this is a non-invasive tool that's been developed by Mayo Clinic and licensed, and I should say the previous one was licensed as well, that basically is going to make it easier to monitor potassium in individuals who are at risk for or have cardiac or renal problems. So these three examples are really what I call pragmatic kind of applied research examples of work that had a very strong research foundation at one point earlier in its lifetime and evolved to a point where it could really see a pathway forward for commercialization. So finally, on this dartboard, not to spend time on all the nuances here, but basically what we've done is to show that if you look at the top, I wish I had a pointer, but if you look at the top, it says at 12 o'clock, it says basic research, and then you go to the center of the Earth, it says patient benefit. And each of those orbits reflects a level of ongoing research that's necessary to go from discovery all the way to impacting human health. And each of the dots that we have on the dartboard are individual projects that we funded, and the arrows simply show that under the aegis of the project development teams and the TPDF award mechanism, we've been able, through a series of metric expectations, milestone expectations, I'm sorry, see these projects move forward. So that's a way that we present the data to indicate to you and others about how this program has been successful in achieving that goal. So I think, Eric, that is the final slide, and we would be more than happy to take questions.
Yes, and I just note that this is our URL for partnership activities and has more information about what we've done and ongoing awards. The other thing you have are your handouts. This one that has the snapshot of partnership accomplishment lists some summary statistics and accomplishments we've had. It also gives you the titles of all the most recent research awards and a few other tidbits about another form of funding that we've released called commercialization funding, again, to help move things from basic discovery into the commercial marketplace. The second handout is this one that lists 5 collaborative research grants, and again, this gives you just a little bit of information about the most recent awards. And then the third one is a magazine article about partnership history and accomplishments of a relatively recent vintage. So with that, again, we would be very happy to answer any questions you might have, and we'd really like to thank you very much for all of your support, and we've been working really hard to live up to the trust you've placed in us.
Thank you. Members, any questions? Senator Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not so much a question, but I'm just wondering, with the research that you're doing and that Dr. Yee and his people are doing with clinical studies, how does that information get to the general practitioners and more specifically to the specialists in the various fields? Are they notified of studies that are going on and results of studies, or is it just sort of up to them individually to try to find this information?
Okay, thank you, Chair Anderson. Senator Newton, one of the big challenges that any academic medical center has is communicating the outcome of our efforts that can actually be used by practicing physicians in the community. And there is not at least within the university, kind of a single site that you can go to get various updates. But I can tell you and I'll just take cancer. I don't know if Dr. Yee is still here, but in the case of cancer, they have a very active community engagement component within the cancer center that is reaching out to oncologists in the community and the various health systems, not just the Fairview system, but all the health systems. And I think one of the things that I've noticed, certainly in my many years in academics, is that you know, in another place in time, university medical centers had a poor, what's called town-gown relationship. In other words, not a very good relationship with the community. And there were reasons for that, but that has totally changed. And a lot of the research that's done at the university or at Mayo is so dependent on community engagement and participation that we can't be successful in 2018 without doing that. So I don't know if I've answered your question as directly as might be helpful, but there's a constant flow of information to physicians, to clinics, and to organizations in the community to give them a better sense for how we can help them.
Additional questions, comments? Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate the presentation. Trying to find, was actually at a couple of these events. It is a historic partnership going back all these years, and appreciate all your work.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Members, just want to remind everybody, we are going to find some dates here coming up on the joint committee for the region selection and then also for the joint convention. But I want to remind everybody, if you're around tomorrow afternoon, we've got the Alumni Association. The University of Minnesota Alumni Association is having their forum from 6 to 8 o'clock over at the State Office Building in Room 10, and that's tomorrow night. It's a very informative process, and Ms. Abramson is out there. I don't know if we have any other candidates, but there will be, I believe, 15 candidates that are going to go through the process tomorrow night, so very informative. So any other comments or questions? If not, we adjourn till Thursday, January 24th at 1 p.m.